Welcome to Lives, a show exploring our experiences in the world and how we might live well. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden. My guest today is conservation biologist and science writer, Connor Gearin. In today's show, Gearin talks about the science and the wonders of the natural world, especially how birds may connect us with the joy of nature and how we humans may live sustainably with the wildlife around us. Gearin also talks about uniting his passion for writing with the science of the natural world as a way for us to see more completely and more strangely.
You can fit birding into your daily life in so many ways, right? When you wake up in the morning, listen to what birds are singing. You know, in our neighborhood, that's American robins. They'll kick off at 4 a.m. And then not stop singing until the sun is set.
Connor Gearin is a writer from St. Louis living in Omaha. He's the managing producer of BirdNote Daily, a daily radio program and podcast. Gearin's work has appeared in The Best American Science and Nature Writing 2019, The Atlantic, Undark, The Millions, The New Territory, New Scientist, and elsewhere. He received an SM in Science Writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and an MS in Biology at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, where he completed thesis research on grassland bird conservation. Gearin is a member of the Audubon Society of Omaha's Board of Directors. Connor Gearin, welcome to Lives.
Thank you so much for having me, Stuart. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you just share a little bit about your childhood and what stands out to you when you look back at that?
Sure. Well, I grew up in St. Louis in a pretty suburban neighborhood. And I think the way I parsed that growing up was I saw myself as growing up on the edge of kind of the city and you know, what lay outside the city. There were woods on the outskirts of the neighborhood that were kind of young, scrappy woods full of honeysuckle and species that were kind of establishing themselves in sort of a disturbed landscape. And so it was in that place that I kind of first recognized my interest in the outdoors and sort of understanding natural places for what they are, rather than kind of received wisdom about those places. Because I think that a place like that is not considered a valuable landscape in one sense. It's sort of a place in between for many people. But as a kid, I would just ride my bike out there and leave it in the grass and just go wandering in the woods and see what I would see. And it was a beautiful place to me. And I think a lot of people have similar experiences with kind of landscapes they grew up next to, be that kind of a suburban woodlot or a vacant lot. I've talked to people who had these very, formative experiences with the nature of a vacant lot and just examining that as a child does with just so much enthusiasm and no sort of preconceived notions about what makes that place, valuable or not. So that's what I remember, is just a lot of time outside. And I had parents that encouraged that interest. My mom is a bird watcher and sort of a broadly defined naturalist as well. And so was able to kind of foster that enthusiasm for the natural world with me and my two sisters. And so I guess what stands out is just the whole family spending a lot of time outside and just enjoying it and experiencing what it had to offer. Yeah.
I appreciate you mentioning that your mother was a bird watcher and otherwise interested in the natural world. I'm curious how it was that these other passions that you had, not just for nature, but specifically for science and also for writing, how did that appear in those early years?
Sure. Well, I had a sixth grade science teacher who really challenged us with biology and with reading way beyond our supposed reading level. He gave us essays by Stephen Jay Gould to read, which I think otherwise I would have encountered in college. But I'm just so glad that he kind of threw that at us as sixth graders, because instantly I was like, oh my goodness, writing about science. I didn't know you could do that as a career. And I just loved the humor that Stephen Jay Gould brings to his writing and just the level of insight about science. And I guess science has something to be enjoyed, not just something that's very a utility, something that can just bring a lot of joy. That was just so evident to me in his writing. So that kind of cursed me at a young age to kind of figure out, okay, how do I do this? And of course, you know, he was a Harvard professor of evolutionary biology. So at first I was like, okay, I have to become a biologist, a PhD, professor of biology to write about science. Eventually I realized, well, there's a lot of people that write about science by interviewing people that are smarter than them and just asking them all of the silly questions until they get, you know, good answers. And, you know, I guess I wound up somewhere in the middle where I do have, you know, a background in biology and the conservation of birds specifically, but what you study in graduate school is so narrow. And for science writers, it's all about talking to other people about what kind of lights their fire and learning from them. And I feel really called to that as well.
I do want to sort of explore a little bit more that foundation that you talked about, which was getting a scientific background academically, sure, immersing yourself in that, but also building the craft of being able to parlay that into written or sort of broadcast format so that it could be shared and distributed with a wider audience. So how was it that you chose to go to college and what did you study and how did that sort of shape your foundation for what came after?
Sure. Well, in college, so I went to Truman State University in Missouri, and that's a public liberal arts school, which was really the right place for me to go because it was meaningful to me that it's a public institution and that it's a liberal arts college that let me major in both biology and English and sort of pursue both interests simultaneously. So I was, at the same time I was taking junior level ecology, I was in a Victorian literature class and finding all kinds of unexpected connections. In Victorian literature, we read Charles Darwin's The Origin of Species, an excerpt from that, right? Something that, you know, still plays into, you know, the basic tenets of ecological theory as it's understood today. And so having a college experience that fostered those connections rather than forcing me to choose one over the other was really valuable. It let me study things that just interested me rather than, okay, I have to stick to this very rigid course of study, be a very serious biologist and not think about anything else. You know, I was taking poetry workshops and classical music courses because that's what you do in a liberal arts and sciences curriculum. And so, you know, I think what that allowed me to do was approach my interest in biology with the lens of a creative nonfiction writer, with the lens of a journalist, all these different ways of looking at it. And I think that helped me kind of start honing my craft for science writing in a very like holistic way rather than just something very rote and focused on data, I guess.
So as I think about the natural world, I just want to ask a big question that we can explore a little bit more deeply as we chat here. But why does the natural world matter to you?
Well, I think that it's inescapable that it's the place and the living system that we all are a part of. It's something where I see people as part of the ecosystem. We do have a huge influence, but ultimately we are sort of subject to the places we live in the same way that every other living thing is. So its value is something that I take for granted because it's inescapable. It's hard to even imagine a way that it would not be valuable. And for me too, I think growing up with an interest in the outdoors as I did, it's something that I take as read, as a given. And I don't often try to defend the natural world's value to people. I just start talking about things that I see and hear and just start telling a story. And I think implicit in that story is, wow, isn't this amazing? Isn't this crucial to how we, you know, live and breathe, rather than trying to start from first principles and explain it logically.
I love how you shared your childhood experiences about existing in what I'm thinking of as these edge lands, these liminal spaces between something that feels urban and something that feels rural or wild in some way. And so I'm wondering about the different perspectives that you see about how people can access something of the natural world if they are living in spaces that are very urban, very manufactured by sort of human architecture, as opposed to or in contrast to these sort of edgeland spaces where you can transition from one to the other just by a quick bicycle ride. And maybe those places where you are actually living in an environment that is purely either agricultural or rural or undeveloped in some way.
Right. Well, it's something that I think, so for the past few years, we've lived in primarily urban places. And so we lived in Quincy, Massachusetts, which is just outside of Boston. We lived in Providence, Rhode Island, which is one of the densest population-wise cities in North America. And we were right in the middle of that. Now we live in Dundee in Omaha, which we love very much. And so these sorts of urban spaces challenged me in a way that my, childhood didn't. A different challenge to experiencing the outdoors. But I think it really is not that different. I think all of these places are sort of edge lands in a way that might not be obvious at first, but just to take Boston as an example, we lived in a 12-story apartment building during COVID, and that was not an easy time to live in the Boston area. But, you know, we also lived next to this remediated marsh, this sort of tidal marsh, pretty far inland, but Quincy being the place that it is, has all these kind of brackish marshes. And so this was a kind of a messy ecosystem. There were plenty of invasive plants there, but there were also tons of birds. There were red-winged blackbirds and snowy egrets, and there were snow geese that would appear sometimes in the winter during migration. There was fantastic wildlife that you could experience just right there, right in the middle of a very densely built-up neighborhood. You could always hear the light rail for Boston off in the distance. So it was very urban, but it was also a place full of life, full of wildlife. And of course, during COVID, I think as many people did, getting outside was essential to me. You know, I would wear a mask outside because we took it very seriously. But you know, I would get outside every day for a 20-minute walk and see what I could see in this, you know, built up neighborhood with lots of multifamily housing. But what did I see? I mean, there were common grackles, there were northern flickers at the soccer field in the local elementary school. I would see red-tailed hawks flying overhead, looking for voles to catch during the day. So you have to take these landscapes seriously in the way that animals do, right? That this is their home. They have to find the resources they need to survive in these places, just like people do. And they are not in any way bereft of wildlife. They're full of wildlife. It just takes a different kind of attention to see these species. But once you see them, you can't unsee it, or you can't unhear it.
You like to write about, explore how the wild world, the natural world, wildlife, and people can live together, coexist together sustainably, which suggests that perhaps we are not doing so as we might at the moment. So what are we perhaps doing wrong?
That's a good question. And I mean, there are so many, so many answers to that. I think I do often start with what's going right, because I feel like in popular media, it's not something that you read about as often. I think there's many great writers doing that very well. I'm not in any way unique in that, but I like to at least first highlight, here are some ways that, you know, we're providing habitat for Nebraska's native grassland birds in ways that you might not expect, or that kind of thing. But it's an important question. I mean, I think to start with the big one, climate change, using fossil fuels to get around. I mean, driving out to parks that I love, I do use a car, and I every time I get in the car, I kind of have mixed feelings about that. It's something where it takes such a profound transformation of our society to change, but it's something we have to do. We can't escape that. I've been trying to at least take the bus with my 1-year-old son to daycare at least a couple days a week. Taking these kinds of small actions makes a big difference in kind of my personal outlook that, okay, I'm doing something, but I also can't escape the big picture that does need to be addressed. And I think that's something we only do through collective action and working together to change these systems. Beyond climate change, I mean, habitat destruction and using landscapes in ways that are burning them out. It's not that we can't farm the land, but we need to do it in a very different way than we are right now. We've lost about 99% of the tall grass prairie in the Midwest. That's an incredible number. And I grew up in the prairie region. I didn't see a prairie until a few years into my life. And really, I should say that was more of a restored grassland than a native prairie that had never been plowed, because pretty much all of that landscape has been converted into corn or soy agriculture, or it has become forest or shrubland, because the sort of natural wildfire regimes and the controlled burns that Native Americans would do historically have by and large stopped in the landscape at large. And so it's a whole scale change of that Midwestern landscape. That's as important to think about as these other challenges that we face is, you know, even if we kind of solve the climate crisis, we still have to deal with this profound loss of our native habitats and finding a way to provide places for wildlife to live alongside us is essential.
I don't know if this is true generally, but I feel as if I see more people being attentive to how they can create micro environments in small spaces in urban settings, whether it's intentional architecture about, for example, grass roofs and this sort of thing, or it's people taking their lawns and actually giving them back to something that is more appropriate for the environment. So in Omaha gardens, for example, that are no longer lawn, but are wildflower gardens. Is this a trend? Is this something that is happening more broadly?
I think it absolutely is. And in New England and in Midtown Omaha, I love walking around and just seeing just the delightful chaos that people let loose in their yards. And just the wildflower species, the sort of pocket prairie concept is a really wonderful one. You can do so much and have so much diversity in a small space. And I mean, that's a wonderful thing for you and your family to have, and for if you have children, for them to grow up with that kind of small scale wild space it's something I really valued as a kid, and so I think it's something I want everyone to have. And that can do wonderful things for especially our native pollinators, right? Where you're offering wildflowers that they can pollinate and they can raise their young on. So I think it is a trend, and it's really great to see when you go out in the neighborhood. But as a bird biologist, primarily, I do have to think about size, right? That yes, absolutely, let's have these pocket prairies and these small scale places, but we do have wildlife that needs space. So a bird like the grasshopper sparrow needs a certain level of acreage to feel secure, to feel like, okay, this grassland is big enough for me to hide from predators. Because if you nest on the ground, you're relying on being hard to find from things like snakes and hawks and skunks and possums that want to eat your young. And so what you do is you're really good at hiding in the grass. But if that grassland isn't big enough for you to hide in, you're a bit out of luck. And so it's a both and situation. Like, let's have the small scale places, but let's also conserve places of a certain size that can host these other wildlife that need more space.
you describe yourself as primarily a sort of a bird biologist. I know a lot of your academic work as well as your vocational work is in relation to birds. So why do birds in particular matter?
I think birds matter because our relationship with birds is so, feels so fundamental, and it feels so scary to lose it. But we are losing birds. There was that big study that came out in 2019 that said we lost 3 billion birds in the past 50 years in North America, which is a number that is hard to wrap your head around. But think about the very common species, right? The American robins, the black-capped chickadees. And yes, they are still abundant, but we've lost so many of these birds. That's happening across generations that can be hard to see for an individual. But we know from the science that we are losing these species. And so it's a matter of acting to preserve this relationship we have with birds that I think is so important for people in very dense cities, in rural areas, that these are the first wildlife you notice in the morning when you wake up, you hear them. When you go out for a little walk, you see them, and they're so accessible. They're so omnipresent in the landscape, and it's just so scary to think that we might lose whole species, lose abundance, right? Losing abundance is something that is not maybe as often talked about, but walking into Elmwood Park in Omaha and seeing and hearing an abundance of birds, right? And thinking about that becoming much more sparse, kind of in the way that Rachel Carson depicted this in Silent Spring, where a town wakes up and there's no bird song. Right. Or just imagine just less birdsong than you're used to. That's kind of what's at stake here. And I think it's just something we don't want to lose.
Also worry that it's something that we don't necessarily notice because it's a slow decline. And I sense that the spring birdsong is not as abundant and not as varied as it used to be. But I don't know if that's just in my head, or if I'm really noticing that there is a decline. And when I walk around my local park around springtime, it doesn't feel as varied and abundant. What is the science behind this?
No, I think you're right. And I think you should trust your instincts in what you're noticing. It's something where if you talk to birders who have done this their whole lives for, 70, 80 years, they will say the same thing, that it's not the same as when they were growing up. You might think, oh, that's just an anecdote, but the science bears this out. We've lost 3 billion birds in the past 50 years, and you're seeing that in your personal life. It's impacting the level of birdsong you see in your neighborhood. That should concern us, I think, not in a doom and gloom way, but like a let's take action about this immediately kind of way at every level, right? Like you can put out birdhouses, you can have native plants in your front yard, or even if you just have a little porch or a deck, put out some pots that a hummingbird is going to visit. Meet up with like-minded people and push for change at the largest scales and also the kind of local scales that can be very impactful as well. So yeah, I think it's something that because you can see it in your personal life, in your neighborhood, it's something that can be very motivating for me and for others to take action.
What are the causes of this decline?
So the principal causes, I would say, are habitat loss and climate change, and climate change becoming an even bigger factor as we go on. The use of pesticides and herbicides are also a huge factor, right? Because so many birds rely on insects to survive. And we often, unfortunately, see insects broadly as just a pest, as something that shouldn't be there. But sure, mosquitoes bite us, but there are, millions and billions of insects that don't, and we need them. We need them to pollinate our crops, for the birds to eat, and we need to make sure that the species that birds rely on are also flourishing. So, there are just these very grave challenges that birds face when they go to migrate, when they go to raise their young, that have led to these massive losses.
So you shared that your mother was a bird watcher, probably still is, I'm sure, a bird watcher. And so you had that sort of exposure. So do you remember when that fascination with birds began for you? And how did you begin, as it were, tuning your eye and learning how to be attentive to the birds around you?
Well, this is a great question. And, you know, it's hard to say where this really began, but I have an interesting kind of natural experiment in raising my one-year-old son. And I've learned from him that interest in birds starts really, really early. So he started noticing birds as like quick movement. I want to say, I don't know, 7, 8 months old. And he would point and he'd, you know, he'd go, gah, and point. And it was so clear that he was picking out birds as something in his environment that he notices. And I was like, wow, I had no idea. So I have to imagine that noticing birds in that way was something that probably happened very early for me. Of course, I don't remember, but I can see that in my son. What I do remember is, you know, in the backyard, noticing northern cardinals singing from a little maple tree in the side yard, and just thinking about, wow, these birds live here. This is their home, even though we think of this as just like a very small space, just a backyard, nothing special for these birds. This is their environment. This is their habitat. That kind of kicked off looking at every outdoor space as potentially a place where wildlife lives and survives and needs to flourish.
And how did you develop that in perhaps what I might think of as a somewhat everyday way of looking at birds that perhaps maybe doesn't seem that exciting? You open your back door and there they are. So it could be sparrows or thrushes or whatever it happens to be, finches. Contrasted with perhaps some of the research you've done, or perhaps the more adventurous exploration you've done to see what might be thought of as more rare or extravagant exotic birds. How do you go about those two ways of watching and examining and considering these birds?
Sure. Well, this is something that we really emphasize on Bird Note Daily, the radio program that I work for, in that you can fit birding into your daily life in so many ways, right? When you wake up in the morning, listen to what birds are singing. You know, in our neighborhood, that's American robins. They'll kick off at 4 a.m. And then not stop singing until the sun is set, basically. Going out for walks, just seeing what you can see, hearing what you can hear. It's something where in sort of the liminal spaces of your life, you can fit birding in, walking to the bus stop, picking up your kid from school, any of that. Anytime you're outside or you're attentive to what's going on around you, part of that is birds. You know, the senior producer of Bird Note, he didn't start out as a birder. He was a musician and you know, a musical producer, but he was working on recording soundscapes in the Seattle area. And he had this realization. He was like, what makes sound? Birds. Birds make sound, you know? And that's so true. Like when we talk about like soundscapes, so much of that is birds. And again, that's true in a city or in a rural area. When you record the birds that are singing, you're also getting information about that habitat. What birds consider this a place they can live? That tells you so much about the biology of that place. The sound does. Once you learn one bird species, you want to learn the next one. And you can't stop. It goes from there, and you just become more and more attentive as time goes on to the species you're seeing and hearing, I think.
You spoke earlier about COVID and how that retuned our way of being in and seeing the world. So what are some other practical tips you might have for people going about their daily lives, perhaps, you know, inundated with everything the world is throwing at them in an urban environment? What are some other tips you have to help people observe the bird life around them, and then perhaps to take it a step further once they've tuned in to how to watch particular birds, perhaps to take it to a slightly more, another level of examination?
Absolutely. Well, I think as a parent, it can be frustrating for me to hear people say, slow down, you know, take 10 minutes for yourself. I'm like, when can I do that? When do you have time in the day for that? But it's true. Like when you can set aside a little time, as much time as you have to sit down or go in any sort of outdoor space that's available to you and just kind of immerse yourself and hear what you can hear, see what you can see. I think that's where it begins, like developing that awareness. And then taking it a step further, I think starts with recording what you're witnessing and observing. That can be taking notes for yourself in a notebook or the notes app on your smartphone. a great way to do this and to keep track of the birds you see, there's an app called eBird. And not only is it a way to keep track of the birds that you're observing, it also, it's a participatory science platform where you are contributing your observations to ornithologists that then can use this to help better understand where birds are, where they're moving, when they're arriving in neighborhoods, and through that information, what we can do to help them. So engaging in that kind of science as a volunteer, as an ordinary person, is really rewarding, and it also teaches you so much about the places you live. Going a step further can also look like treating your front yard or backyard as a wild place and planting it with wildflowers and native ground cover, native grasses, putting up birdhouses, that kind of thing. And certainly a big one is keeping your cat indoors. Cats kill an incredible number of birds, unfortunately. And so if you're able to keep your cat indoors, that does make a huge difference. So there's all kinds of ways to take action. I think a big one to always mention is, you know, finding organizations where you can pitch into a larger effort. You know, here in Omaha, I'm a part of the Audubon Society of Omaha, and contributing to these larger groups that can make an impact at larger scales is really rewarding and really valuable. Yeah.
So a quick turn then to you, when you think about more adventurous birding, what does that look like for you?
Sure. I mean, at first I want to say, you know, it's something where you don't have to be, I guess, adventurous to experience birds. That, you know, you can go to the park down the street or just walk around the neighborhood. But sure, there are times where you want to see something different. For me, adventurous is pretty modest. I look at the places I live as like a place for adventure. I don't need to drive 2 or 5 hours as some birders will do to like chase down a rarity. I want to get on my bike and see how far I can get by bike and what can I see. I also use biking as a way to extend, like, let's say, you know, again, as a parent, I don't have a ton of time to myself, which is great and wonderful. I'm not complaining, but let's say I have an hour on a Sunday to see as much as I can see. Well, if I bike out 30 minutes and then, you know, I have a little bit of time to like see wherever I end up, whether that's a, you know, a grassland on the edge of town or something, then I can kind of make that time more valuable to myself by getting out a little further and seeing something a little different than I normally do in my daily life. But sure, absolutely. I mean, in Omaha, we have so many wonderful places that are within arm's reach. Hitchcock Nature Center and the Luss Hills are such an amazing landscape. You know, I talk about like Midwestern landscapes as amazing. And I think if people are not from here, they might see that as kind of quaint, or I'm just sort of talking up something that's not that interesting. I truly see the Luss Hills as an amazing place where you have these very steep eroding hills that were built up with windblown silt a long, long time ago. And so you have this transition zone between the tall grass prairie and sort of bluff forests. And it's a very dynamic landscape transformed by fire and by grazing and all of this. And so it really rewards close attention. And, you know, I think these places are worth taking seriously in the same way that, you know, the BBC wildlife unit does these very grand places. Like, let's really consider the landscapes near where we live as amazing, wonderful places themselves.
You are a science writer, and I read a piece that you wrote, and you declared that biology for you is ultimately about writing, about seeing more completely and more strangely. And so I'm curious then, how is science writing perhaps different than other kinds of writing for you?
Well, I think that science writing, like other kinds of journalism or nonfiction, it's fact-based writing. And so it's something where it requires a certain level of research and a certain level of, you know, reading or talking to experts to kind of develop your understanding of the subject. And I think through that research, you can find new perspectives and new ways of seeing the world that, you know, if you were to just kind of stay in your own kind of imaginative headspace you wouldn't get to. And so that's what I love about science writing is it forces me to talk to people who think differently than me. I do mostly write about biology and wildlife, but I've talked to astrophysicists about black holes, and I've talked to chemical engineers about creating new kinds of substances and materials that will hopefully make our world more sustainable. Hearing these people explain their work and kind of how they see the world gives you so many different lenses with which to approach your writing. And so I guess that's what I love about science writing most of all. Yeah.
You've already mentioned a couple of really phenomenal writers. You've mentioned Darwin. You also mentioned Carson and Silent Spring. So how has your writing been influenced in terms of not making it too fact-based, even though science is essentially this fact-based reasoning subject matter? But how have you borrowed from those influences to make the science writing feel compelling and accessible?
Absolutely. Well, it's hard not to want to be exhaustive in naming the writers that have influenced me here, but I have to start with Annie Dillard, wonderful nonfiction writer. Her book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, I read that at a fairly young age and I think a very formative age in my writing. And she is someone who is sort of haunted by science, who is just blown away by the scientific facts of the world. She reads incredibly widely, reads a lot of scientists, but she also has just an incredible imagination, something that's very humbling for me. I know I can never reach her level of wildness in her writing, but reading her talking about basically the backyard cedar tree, she calls it the tree with the lights in it. There was one moment she remembers where the sun kind of struck the needles of this cedar tree in a way that just seemed illuminated. It was like Moses and the burning bush for her. And so seeing, you know, the numinous and the unusual in the everyday was something that was, I think, a gift that Dillard gave to me. And it's something that can make writing about the natural world more imaginative, where it's not just facts and figures. It's also, what does this do to us? What does it do to our imaginations? And that is a big part of its value, I think, is the strangeness and kind of bearing witness to that strangeness, even in, you know, what we think of as everyday nature.
You've mentioned Bird Note. So on the one hand, there's writing, which is a particular form that involves, as it were, you know, the mind's imagination. With modern technology, there are so many other ways to present and to digest what essentially is content about how we embody ourselves in the world. It's all five senses and more. So with Bird Note, tell me a little bit more about what Bird Note is and how it's trying to parlay content in a different way.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we air on public radio stations, and our hope is that this is a moment of joy for people. You know, we're an interstitial program, 2 minutes long. And so it's just a quick dose of bird song and a story about a bird or a place where birds live, or a person who's kind of taking action to help birds. You know, we try to immerse our listeners in a soundscape, be that a place that is very accessible and nearby, or maybe a place that they haven't been to before that we want to talk about that's essential to birds. In either case, we try to make that an immersive soundscape. We're really fortunate to have sounds recorded by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Their Macaulay Library is just an incredibly rich resource of bird songs and calls. And with Bird Note, we try to engage people with stories. And so implicit in those stories is the message that birds matter, and that you're drawn in by the story and by a bird surviving in its habitat. And so along the way, you learn, okay, these are the things that matter to this bird, and here's how I can help. I think we're very focused on joy and you know, on birds as a source of consolation throughout the day. But it's also a reciprocal relationship. We hope that you're also paying respect to these birds through helping them out, through taking action in whatever way that you can.
Is there one of these short stories that you've worked on that you particularly have enjoyed?
It's hard because we're a daily show. So we air a show every day. So I've worked on a lot of these. But what stands out? I mean, I'll just give one example at hand. I mean, one day in Rhode Island, I was out in a small grassland and I saw a great blue heron kind of walking along a trail through this grassland. And you might know that great blue herons, they are aquatic predators. They mostly eat fish and frogs and things like that. I had never seen a heron behaving in this way. So I was just, you know, there were plenty of bird illnesses going around. I was like, is there something wrong with this bird that it's so far inland? And I looked it up afterwards and it turns out, you know, actually great blue herons will go and eat rodents and pursue prey on land. And so I ended up writing a show about that experience. And so I think that bird note shows begin with that kind of enthusiasm and curiosity, whether it's a show written by me or one of our many other very talented writers. It's something where we're witnessing something about the natural world and we get really excited and want to tell other people about it. That's kind of where those stories come from.
Not that bird note is a counterpoint to this, but I think many of us may encounter stories about birds rarely, and it might be sensational and often sad. So, for example, I'm thinking of Flaco, the owl that recently died in New York City. Flaco is a Eurasian eagle owl that escaped from or was released illicitly from New York City's zoo a year or so ago, but recently flew into a tall building and the impact killed it. But this made news across the country. But it's a sad story, and it doesn't really bring us into this experience of the natural world. If anything, it just juxtaposes nature with man-made infrastructure. I don't know if you feel as if the stories we tell are well told, or if we're telling the wrong kind of stories, if we're even telling stories enough at all about our experience of the natural world.
Right. Well, I think this is where having a background in how you tell a story is so important in how I think about telling stories for Bird Note. And I had the pleasure of talking to Emily Rabiteau, a writer based in New York, about Flaco, and it is such an impactful story. You know, people loved this bird, and it, you know, so Flaco, a Eurasian eagle owl that escaped from the zoo and then treated Manhattan as his landscape and as the place he was going to survive. Yes, not native to North America, but like our native birds, he was treating New York as the place he lived and survived on. And just like a scrappy animal that was making do, people were so in love with this bird. He actually was singing, trying to find a mate, and people recorded him singing. And there's something kind of sad and haunting about that, right? But you know, this was a bird that was living his life. And I think what that story teaches us is one that, you know, yes, birds are living in a very serious way right next to us in Manhattan and in the biggest, you know, cities of the world. And also it teaches us about the challenges they face. You know, I think that, and I have to give credit to Emily Rabiteau for telling me the story in this way. This is a chance to understand the challenges that birds face, because there are things we can change in terms of rodent pesticides that are so harmful to our raptors, to our owls and hawks and eagles. That's something we can change. The issue of window strikes, we can make our windows more visible to birds through special decals, through changing how new buildings are built and setting new regulations for windows. We can make very populated spaces safer for birds. It does not have to be an either or situation. There's so much we can do. And I think that's the lesson I draw from Flaco, among many other things, is, you know, it's a chance to reflect on the birds that live right alongside us and how we can help them.
I've read something else that you wrote, and you said that you have two preoccupations that often feel at odds: science and writing. And it feels like on the one hand, we're talking about science as a rigorous practice, and writing perhaps is something that is more free and the subject matter is more mysterious. Have you managed to unify these two endeavors?
yes, I think as time goes on, I do see them as so interlinked and not so different. First of all, scientists write a lot. They write, I hate to say it, they write more words than a lot of creative writers because they have to. They write so many scholarly articles and books and book chapters. That is the currency of science. And it's easy to kind of discredit that writing as not imaginative or creative. There's so much creativity and ingenuity that goes into designing an experiment. And then when you go to write it up, you're not just kind of rotely saying exactly what you did. You're summarizing, you're synthesizing and pulling out what is important from that experience. Is that any different from what an essayist does when they're talking about, you know, their own experience? I think it's the same. So seeing these different kinds of writing as not so different, pulling from the same skill set is something that is really important to me. It's a message I try to share with scientists very often because they, I know a lot of them and they get very down on their writing, but I see them as writers. And I also think it's so important for people who are primarily writers to, you know, engage with science and engage with these kind of data-based ways of learning, because not because it's more important than the humanities. I certainly disagree with that kind of line of thinking, but more so because it offers different ways of seeing the world and it can improve your writing and give you new ways of imagining and exploring the world you live in.
Earlier, you mentioned Annie Dillard and you talked about finding the numinous in the everyday. Does science get in the way of wonder?
Well, that's a great question. Perhaps it can on the personal level if, you know, I've experienced this where science is a job and your job can be, you know, it can steal wonder from you if you let it. That's always a danger. I think that is more so the danger. I don't think science as a practice, as a way of learning things about the world is like an enemy to wonder. I think it's actually a tool through which you can find wonder and you can, a lot of science is focused on incremental discoveries and just moving things a little bit forward. And what's beautiful about that, I think, is the level of attention that scientists pay to very small phenomena. So there's nothing, I don't see that as boring or kind of like stamp collecting. I see that as people who see the natural world as amazing and they want to understand it. That's maybe different than the way that, you know, Annie Dillard or, you know, a very imaginative writer does, but scientists have imaginations. Of course they do. And they want to learn more about the world in the best way that they can. Yeah.
What have you learned about yourself? I'm picturing you in those edgelands as a child, exploring this natural world that's just a stone's throw from where you live. And you've traversed science, academics, being amazed by the natural world, both small and grand. What have you learned about yourself?
What I've learned about myself, one is that I can't sort of live without writing. I don't want to. It's something that writing about just the simple act of going outside and seeing what I see, even if it's just for myself, kind of a journal type writing, it's something that is kind of a daily bread for me. And you know, I only try to publish the stuff that might be interesting to other people, but I think for anyone, whether you consider yourself a writer or not, it can separate one day from the other. It can teach you about the place you live. What else has it taught me? I mean, I think it's taught me, as I mentioned before, like you can understand the place you live through the wildlife that call it home. And so by paying attention to the birds that are there and the mammals and the plants and mosses, you can understand your neighborhood as a habitat and kind of understand it biologically. And that can give you a greater appreciation for its value. And seeing yourself as part of a larger ecosystem keeps you humble. It keeps you focused on what I see as the things that matter, rather than getting lost in kind of your private concerns and worries. You know, if you can stay focused on your larger ecosystem and the people and creatures you share it with, that helps me at least keep my mental wellness in place and in balance. And I guess I've learned that that is how I do it.
I love how you say being attentive to your place in the natural environment, the ecosystem, makes you humble. Are you a better human because of your attention to the natural world?
I hope so. I think that a lot of writers have talked about this, that paying attention can make you a better person. Absolutely. And I think that what it can offer is not dismissing the value of the everyday, which is all we have. Ultimately, I there's not another world out there that we're waiting for. This is it. You know, the neighborhood you live in, this is what matters. This is what you have to cultivate and protect. And so having that awareness, learning the ways you can help and pitch in and be a good member of your ecosystem. Yes, I think it is one way you can be a better person. Absolutely.
My guest today has been conservation biologist and science writer, Connor Gearing. Connor, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Stuart. It's been a pleasure.
Lives is brought to you on KIOS Omaha Public Radio and is produced by Courtney Bierman. The music you hear playing in and playing out is performed by Andrew Bailey. Podcasts of today's show and others can be found at livesradioshow.com or where you get your podcasts. Subscribe today and please leave a review. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden. Join me next week as we delve further into the practical and profound possibilities of living well. Thanks for listening.
Don't want to offend the stamp collectors. I have a lot of respect for that.